Welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ellie Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you have a piece out at American Greatness this week in which you lay out an agenda for what a Trump re-election campaign, and I suppose by extension a Trump second term, should look like. And that's what I want to talk about today, but why don't we start by laying the predicate for that and talking about where the campaign is now in mid-July. The media and polling consensus is that the president is significantly behind Joe Biden and that this is not going well for him. So some signs that the president himself is unhappy, given that he's changed the leadership of his campaign here just within the last week. So what do you judge the current state of the campaign to be?
I think it's kind of analogous to this period at 2016. When people were looking at these mainstream media polls and, you know, saying he was done for. But as I said earlier, you know, Dukakis was up 17 in August over George H.W. Bush. Carter was up until, I think, three months before the election over Reagan. So I think people are so concerned or absorbed with the contagion, the lockdown, the recession, that they haven't really turn to the campaign. And it's all going to hinge, I think, on whether we have a traditional campaign that discusses issues with real candidates, or we have a virtual campaign that is mired with the COVID virus and the hysteria and arguing over to open schools and all that. If we have a traditional campaign where Biden actually goes out and campaigns, and then he has debates and there's issues and that hardcore AOC agenda is put out for America, then they're going to lose. If, on the other hand, he stays in the basement and the media says that he's not really left wing, that he's good old Joel from Scranton. And all the media does is, you know, Trump caused the virus, Trump caused the recession, Trump caused the quarantine, and then Trump in reaction gets angry and goes after Jeff Sessions again, or, you know, Bubba, what's his name, in the NASCAR, then it's not going to look good. So we'll see what happens. But there's no way that he could not win if he would just give us an agenda and frame Biden as an empty vessel for socialists and then let the news cycle work in his favor.
So let's talk about that agenda that you suggested. The first thing on your to-do list for Trump is the one where you say he's actually made the most progress so far, which is standing up for what you refer to in this piece as America pre-May 25th. So before the protests and the riots and the unleashing of the Jacobin spirit that we've seen the past few months. So what does that look like in practice? Is that purely a matter of defiance against what kind of aspires to be the new orthodoxy, or is this also calling on Trump to attempt to be something of a healing figure?
Well, it's a healing figure in that life was pretty good before the virus and all that, and we can return to that. So what he's going to say, and I think he did pretty well in the Mount Rushmore speech and the 4th of July lecture the next day, is that he is the iconic resistance to blue state laxity, to statue topping, to renaming, to the violence, then he's going to stand up for traditional America. And that's not going to get him reelected, but that's going to help him, especially if this violence and demonstrations continue. So I think he's done that pretty well. I think everybody realizes if you're a barber in LA and you want your business reopened, then Trump's your guy. And if you're a suburban mom and you don't think 9/11 is going to come, then Trump's your guy. But that's not enough to get him elected, that alone. But it will help. It's one of three things, I think, as you pointed out.
Okay, so on policy, which you write quite a lot about in this piece, your first prescription there is to unleash Trump the Builder, finally advance this long-promised infrastructure agenda. So what would this look like? What should the constituent parts of that be?
Well, money aside, a lot of people, when they talk about infrastructure, they look at the never completed intercontinental freeway system. And by that, I mean I'm sitting in a state where there's only really two ways to get to Nevada. You either go through Lake Tahoe or you go around the Sierra. But there were four or five avenues that were planned that were never built. Or the 99 and the 101 have never been completed the way they were envisioned in the 60s. That is six lanes the length of the state. It just never were. So completing that freeway system and then roads and, you know, tertiary roads, dams, reservoirs, with the idea that you're trying to reconnect these rural parts with the major cities, because it looks like, given the defunding police movement, the spike in crime, the lockdown and dependency of people in apartments, and the sheer toxicity of high-density living in time of mass transit elevator, that there's going to be a lot of people who want to work outside cities, or at least spend only half their time in there. And so it would be a good way to kill two birds with one stone.
The second point here, you say that he needs to create a task force to deal with the next epidemic, which does invite the question, what have we learned so far from this one? What would we want to do differently if we were planning for a rerun of something on the scale of COVID-19?
Well, I think we would like to have a set of a scheduled escalation. So when we hear about, and we'll hear another one from China, because either through laxity or by intent, there's been too many coronaviruses, too many MERS viruses, too much plague, and we'll hear another one. So I think we'd have to have, the people would be told, when we hear that a virus is found outside of China or is found in a, you know, in a outside of a particular city, then we're going to follow the following escalated steps. And they would be things like flights shut off, people, flights to China shut off, connecting flights from Europe shut off, issuing masks. It would be graduated. So there'd be some logic to it. And then we would redefine, we would get a board that, I mean, we're in 4 months and we still can't agree whether it kills 3% of people or it kills 0.2%. And that's because the left keeps saying the real lethality rate is only those who, that is based only on the denominator of those who were tested. And the conservatives say, well, no, it's everybody that has antibodies who were tested, and then all the people who were sick and never got tested for either. And so it's 10 times larger. So we need to get a national formula for defining the lethality rate, and then a national medical board, so we don't get in this hydroxychloroquine debate again, whether it's got efficacy, when it does, but it's, a lot of people died because it probably wasn't used. So I think that would be the kind of things I was thinking about, as well as stockpiling gloves. I went to the store today and there was no sanitizer. There was toilet paper, but there were no masks on sale at Home Depot. And, you know, everybody wants an N95 mask, and you used to be able to buy them a whole case, $20 for 25 masks, and there's none. So we need to make an inventory, a stockpile, and I think we can do that. That would psychologically reassure a lot of people.
Third here, an interesting point. You say, obviously, first priority with the economy has to be getting it back on its feet, but once it's there, you suggest that it's time for the president to do something he hitherto hasn't shown that much interest in, and that's to get serious about the national debt. So explain why that is so important at this moment.
Well, what it's done is, it's in, to pay off this, we're going to get near $30 trillion. So to pay that annual service fee, you really have to have zero interest. Zero interest is fine if you owe money, but if you don't owe money, and you're saving, say you're a couple, he looked at the post office, she was a teacher, they have $100,000, they're 60 years old, they're ready to retire, and they've got, and they don't know anything about the stock market, they don't want to buy and sell real estate. So they put their $100,000 in their savings, and they get 1%. They're lucky. That's nothing. And so they're basically subsidizing people who were buying and selling homes at 3% interest rates. And so that's one way of dealing with a debt, but it's not a good way. It hasn't been good to have these non-existent, and they are non-existent when you factor in inflation. The other thing is, they'll have to renounce some debt. We saw that with the Obama administration when Chrysler went under. They reversed the order of the creditors. And so a lot of these, I don't know how some of these small communities in California are going to meet their California retirement system, their PERS requirements. Each city has a certain formula they have to pay. I don't know how they're going to do that. It's $1,000 a student now in California for the STIRS program, the retirement system. But you can imagine they're going to have to renounce some debt. Somebody is. And that's not good. Or you can inflate the currency, like we did under Jimmy Carter and under Nixon, where we just, whip inflation now. I'm speaking to somebody who started farming, and I remember buying sulfur bags, and they would say $1.50 crossed out, $1.65 crossed out, $1.70 crossed out, and then, $2.05. In other words, just in inventory, they were going out at, 1%, 2% a month. So none of those are good things. So we got to start doing something pretty quickly.
So next up on your agenda here, you suggest that it's time for the federal government to seriously rethink its relationship with education policy, especially as regards higher education. So what would that look like in tangible terms?
That'd be pretty easy to do, actually. So if you take, I guess, Harvard's 60 or 70 billion, Stanford, I guess, is nearing 30 to 40. You could just say, after $1 billion, we really don't think that you guys are non-political, non-partisan, non-profit anymore. You're ideologically propagandizing an entire generation of Americans. So if you want to do that, and you do want to do that, we're going to tax your income. And so if they get, $100 million a year off their endowment, they can get $3 billion a year, they're going to have to pay income tax on it. And that would really shake them up. And then I think they have to accept moral hazard of $1.6 trillion, $1.7 trillion in loans. Believe me, if Stanford, to take our own institution, was telling students when they gave that aid package, well, here's your loan, and we're guaranteeing it. And so we don't want you to default, so we're trying to cut expenses to save you money. But when you'd say, it's not our problem. The federal government's going to guarantee it, even if it's 6 or 7%. And they don't care about whether you have a viable job on graduation. That would really change things. I think tenure could be rewritten as five-year contracts, so people actually had to meet. That's kind of an idiosyncratic habit I have, because I was on the post-tenure committee at the California State University, where I taught, and believe me, right at 6 years, the productivity of faculty members dropped off, and by the time they were 20 years after tenure, they were, three-quarters of them were not doing any research, they were poor teachers, and there was nothing you could do about it. And then finally, a couple of little quick things. I think I know they're trying to get rid of the SAT, but I would rather see an SAT exit exam. Maybe even Black Lives Matter would go for that. And that would mean, they said before, we had to have an SAT to standardize admission because they didn't believe that the GPAs of particular schools were as competitive as other ones. Well, maybe the same is true of colleges. I'd like to see how somebody from Hillsdale tests on the SAT after 4 years compared to somebody at Stanford. But you could come up with a minimum amount that would guarantee the BA meant something. Then finally, this is an esoteric one too, but it's very important. Just give everybody who graduates who wants to go into teaching K through 12 the option of ever either going to the School of Education, to that therapeutic industry, and getting a credential, or they can go to an academic program for a year and get a master's degree. And that would really, I think, reinstill academics to the university, and it would make the teachers so much better qualified in the classroom to have a year to read English literature or do more physics rather than that stuff that they teach at School of Education.
In addition to the policy suggestions here, you've also got some suggestions about communications, the first of which has to do with how the president handles Joe Biden, who's proven to be somewhat elusive given the unusual nature of this campaign. And then the second is about how he uses that famous Twitter account. So walk us through those.
Well, everybody's mad at Biden because they kept saying, well, he's just in the basement. He's in the bunker. He's cheating. And when he doesn't do interviews. He doesn't do press conferences. And when he does, rarely he has it scripted, so he even misremembers the names of the people he's supposed to call on. This is a travesty. The only way you're going to get him out is you're going to have to force him out. And you have to force him out by attacking him every day and getting your own polls up to 45%. And then once he sees that you're ascending, then he will get out. And once he gets out, he will descend and you will ascend more. And that's the catch 22. So they've got to get him out of the bunker, and they have to explain to people that he's an empty vessel. He's a wraith. He's a spirit. He's a specter. And we saw a very strange conversation on Russian television with Angela Davis. And I was very surprised. She just admitted that. She said, well, I don't like either candidate, but at least with Biden, you know, the guy's going to give us all this space and we can enact an anti-racist leftist agenda. And so she had it right. That's what they're doing. And the vice president's nomination for the first time, I don't know, in 75 years is really a de facto presidential nomination. And so they've got to make that point that he's not able to campaign and force him out, shame him, and then talk about the agenda that is going to be implanted within Joe Biden's brain. And that's everything from reparations to defunding the police to the wealth tax to the Green New Deal. And then as far as the Twitters, that's kind of old ground. We all know that when the country is in a period of crisis, it doesn't help Trump to, in the last 30 days, to go after an obviously defeated and dejected Jeff Sessions. We knew he was going to lose. There was no need to say that he was, you know, I don't know what all the things he tweeted, but they were non-necessary. Same about Joe Scarborough or NASCAR drivers. Not so much. I don't mind the invective, really, because I'm not so idealistic anymore. I'm just thinking it's a waste of time. So the way I look at the campaign is there's a little over 100 days left. Every single hour is precious. Every single tweet is precious. And he's walking on stepping stones through a minefield. And one false step and he blows up. And he can do it, because remember, after the Access Hollywood tape of 2016, everybody said he was all through. He debated very well that night, and then they had a brilliant idea of bringing Bill Clinton's girlfriends in there. And the next thing you knew, he was down 12. And next thing we knew, the next week, he was only down 8.
So the final question that I'll put to you, Victor, one thing that this article doesn't touch on is foreign policy. And I'm less interested really about this as a campaign issue than I am in thinking through what the president faces if he's getting ready for a second term 6 months from now. To what degree is the landscape different in a second term than in a first on the international side? Are there challenges you anticipate him facing in that scenario that are different, either in degree or in kind, than the ones he's already faced?
Yeah, I didn't mention it because I have a long article coming out on that topic in the next National Review print. And there are really just four challenges. There's China, and there's Russia, and there's Iran and North Korea. And then there's our relationship, I guess, with Europe. But with China, I think China, its attitude now is, well, things happen, and we're not going to be contrite anymore, and we're not going to apologize, and we're not going to give you any more information, because we realize that this thing really flattened the West in a way we could have never imagined. It's caused everything from recession to civil war in the United States. And you know what? We know it. And if you better straighten up, because we could do this again and again, and what are you going to do about it? So that's their new attitude. And we have to find ways to deter them by suggesting to them the next time it happens, they're not going to like what's going to happen to them. And then we need to talk to very seriously. It'll be very easy, too, because Australia and Taiwan and Japan and South Korea have all jumped up their military spending. They're all rearming at a fanatic rate. So that's one issue. The other is Russia, and that's Russia's kind of a strange deal because it doesn't have it's got an economy that's 1/20th the size of ours. It can cause trouble in Syria. It tries to break Germany out of NATO and break Turkey out of NATO. But really, it's just 7,000 nuclear weapons that it has. And we always understood that it was no good, communist or not, but it was valuable in balancing China off. I think I mentioned that before and broadcast it. Kissinger's dictum that China shall not be friendlier to Russia than it is to us, and Russia shall not be friendlier than it is to us with China. So that's a good idea. So we need to use Putin as a foil against China, and that would be valuable. And then Iran, we're doing very well because getting out of the Iran deal, upping the sanctions, becoming energy independent of the Middle East, at the same time Israel, fostering that new alliance of Israel, moderate Mideast states, that's all set Iran way back. And then China's their patron, so they didn't get any mileage too much out of that. China wasn't especially nice to Iran during the contagion. Iran suffered a great deal. So they're weaker than they ever have been. And if you compare where Iran was in 2017 in January, where it is now, it's night and day, and they know it. And North Korea is the same thing. It's into a second year of really hard sanctions. China's reeling a little bit. So I think we're doing all four. We're doing pretty well with all four of those challenges. As far as NATO goes, it's very hard to pump in vitality into a 75-year-old alliance, which was created to keep Germany down, us in, and Russia out, when China's the main problem in the world, along with probably Islamic terrorism, I suppose. And Germany, it's up in a weird way. It's not a military power, but it's very anti-American. It's very pro-Russian. And there's not much we can do about that. So Trump did pretty well in jawboning their NATO contributions. But the idea that Europe and the United States are going to be bosom buddies, it's not going to happen under Trump. And it didn't really happen under Obama either for a variety of different reasons. So I think that Pompeo's foreign policy has been pretty good.
You've been listening to The Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.